Well, good afternoon, Juno. It's about 15 seconds before 3 o'clock on a rainy afternoon in Juno. So we're doing Juno Afternoon. It's not raining in the studio, I'll tell you that. My first guest today is an interesting fellow named Seneca Harper. He's going to tell us about a show that's coming to the Perseverance Theater that involves burlesque. Tune in, Juno. Okay. Fellow from Anchorage going to be on the second slot of the show. Larry Yerich is going to join me and talk about an upcoming set of meetings between the USDA and Alaska tribal governments. And let's see, we'll also be hearing from Mitt Metcalf, who will be here to talk about Monday's picnic to celebrate the Alaska National Guard. Weather? Well, it's raining out there, and it's going to continue. Heavy at times this afternoon, highs around 63, southeast winds 10 to 15 miles per hour, gusts to 25 in the middle of the showers.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Jacqueline Estes, filling in for Antonia Gonzalez. In Oklahoma, the Chickasaw Nation has opened a new clinic that can provide many more services to its citizens. KGOU's Kurt Gwartney has the story.
The new healthcare facility is six times the size of the old clinic and will have four times the staff. Chickasaw Nation Governor Bill Anitubby called the opening of the facility a major milestone in enhancing the health of Native Americans in southeast Oklahoma. The new clinic encompasses 66,000 square feet and will increase its staff to 100 workers. The tribe says the staffing increase was made possible through the Indian Health Service Joint Venture Funding Program. Anitubby says the Chickasaw Nation's health care team can now provide more services, including behavioral health, physical therapy, a drive-through pharmacy, audiology, and mammography. The tribe started planning on the project in 2009 as patient visits to the old clinic continued to dramatically increase. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Gwartney in Norman, Oklahoma.
The Wyoming Department of Education recently released the results of proficiency assessments for Wyoming students, or PAWS. In reading, the state improved by about 2 percentage points, but the Arapaho School on the Wind River Reservation, which serves 350 Native American students, jumped an average of 13 points. Irina Zhorov of Wyoming Public Radio reports.
Last August, the Arapaho School approached the Wyoming Department of Education for help. 2011 PAWS results showed low proficiency in reading, and the school wanted assistance in improving students' performance. Arapaho and the Department of Education agreed on a literacy program called Wyoming Read, or WIRE. 125 students participated in the program. Instructional leader for the Department of Education, Shirley Lane, says the approach was straightforward.
Kind of a common sense approach to intervening with kids is to get smaller and smaller group sizes with a tutor or with an expert adult. WIRE is just one-on-one or one-on-two-or-three small group intervention using really good reading comprehension strategies.
All grades except 7th saw a jump in the 2012 PAWS results, with 4th graders showing 58% proficiency from last year's 18%. Despite the overall significant improvements, Arapaho's results are still far below the state average of 78% proficient or advanced for tested students. Lane says some challenges for the Arapaho school include its remote location, highly transient students, low attendance, and high turnover of leadership in the school. It's not yet clear if the WIRE program will continue next year. For National Native News, I'm Irina Zhorov.
On this date in 1994, the Native American Journalists Association issued a proclamation calling for a halt to the use of Native American nicknames, logos, and mascots for sports teams, an end to the use of the word fighting before tribal names, and the use of actual tribal names when referencing tribes. Aimed at news and other media, the statement was issued at the first Unity Journalists of Color Conference, which was held in Atlanta, Georgia. Unity members adopted the resolution on July 28, 1994. 6,000 people attended Unity that year, making it the first large gathering of journalists of color. Participants included the Native American Journalists Association, National Association of Hispanic Journalists, National Association of Black Journalists, and the Asian American Journalists Association. This year's Unity Conference is being held in Las Vegas, Nevada from August 1st to the 4th. This is National Native News. I'm Jacqueline Estes.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation.
With funding from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's about 5.5 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. My first guest is bringing a special show that he's put together and is just coming off of a worldwide tour, European tour, I guess. Seneca Harper is here. Seneca, you're an old Juneauite.
I am an old Juneauite. I grew up here in Juneau, and it's good to be back. It's a little wet.
It never was when you were here before, right?
Well, it seems rainier the more time I spend abroad.
Okay. So tell us about the show that is coming.
This show that I'm bringing tomorrow night, actually, mm-hmm. at Perseverance Theater, has been a show that my group put together in Seattle, and we've been touring Western Europe and the East Coast of the U.S. and, you know, over to the West Coast. And it's been really enjoyable for all of us. It's highly comical. It's a boylesque show, and there's a lot of exciting choreography, fantastic costumes, and really silly antics.
Boylesque, an interesting word. Where does that come from?
Boylesque, the term was coined a while ago, but basically it means male burlesque. And it's kind of a comical term. We use it because it's easier for marketing, you know, to set us apart from the millions of women who are performing burlesque and who always have been. It's easier to say, hey, this show is going to be a little bit different.
Mm-hmm. So what makes a show burlesque?
The word burlesque originally means to parody. So most people use burlesque as a form of some sort of social commentary. Burlesque also involves the removal of costumes to reveal smaller costumes underneath, and there's several different layers. Usually the last layer is very, very small.
Very small.
Yeah.
Okay.
Legal limits, obviously. But my troupe uses a lot of comedy in our social commentary most of the time, and this show at Perseverance tomorrow night does have some social commentary, but it's also just a good time.
Before the show, you were telling me a little bit about how you got into this. Can you go back into that story a little bit for everybody?
Yeah, so we were in the same room with Jeff Brown, and Jeff Brown was telling you how I grew up here as his apprentice, you know, learning magic and learning a clown. And I went by Blue the Clown, spelled B-L-U, mind you. And I knew I loved transforming, wearing some sort of makeup and transforming into this fantastical creature and getting to impress people. At the time, I just liked, you know, to flash and dazzle. So I was about 7 or 8, and I continued that until I was about 13, and it wasn't really socially acceptable in school. So I've always had that duality, the double life. Anyhow, I started getting involved in dance and theater, and I knew that when I graduated high school, I wanted to move somewhere for theater. And I auditioned for a school in New York City, a school in California, and a school in Seattle. And I got into all of the schools, and I visited all of the campuses, and the one that I connected with most was Seattle. So I moved to Seattle, and I started studying theater, and everything was great. I took a year off because it's a very expensive private school, and during the summers, I was a whale-watching guide, and I learned that I had a knack for teaching people about ecology and how humans are an integral part of the environment. So it sounds kind of like a big leap in logic, but I really decided, you know, I love theater and I love dance, but I want to use my theatrical skills to help teach people about environmental issues. So I said goodbye to theater and I started working on my Associates of Science degree, still in Seattle, and I burnt myself out completely working 40 hours a week and taking 15 credits, and I'd heard that, you know, people have been doing that for years, but I just could not do it. And I was completely creatively starved. So that spring, I stumbled across a burlesque show.
Where?
And the burlesque show was in Seattle, And I was completely blown away. I was also upset. I was upset because no one had told me that this art form exists before. When I heard the word burlesque, you know, I thought of pretty boring classical feather fans and pearls and diamonds and red velvet curtains, but I didn't know that it could be, you know, performance art, social commentary. It could be funny, it could be exciting, and it could be whatever you want it to be, really.
Yeah.
So I knew that I had to be a part of it, and the rest is history.
So what characters are you in this?
In this show...
I assume that you guys... You run like a two-hour show, right?
It's about an hour and 40 minutes.
So with three people and Lenny...
Lenny,
on stage. She's the woman who sings and...
Lenny is the only one who plays multiple characters. And when you see the show, it'll all make sense to you.
Oh, okay.
She plays multiple characters. The rest of us three... play superheroes. So we play one character throughout the show, and each of us has a special power, and you have to come to the show to figure out what that is.
Okay. All right.
And throughout the show, at the beginning, the issue is that there's no crime in Status Quovia, which is this little city that everyone's visiting for the evening.
Okay. Yeah. I like it.
All is well.
Uh-huh.
And everything's fine. So the first act is our backstory. You know, it's where these superheroes have come from, and how did they learn to discover their powers.
And, of course, with no crime, they're kind of out of work, right?
Exactly.
I got it.
So, you know, they are unemployed superheroes. So then the second act, there is a little bit more action, and you discover, well, there's something wrong in the world. And then, of course, the third act is more of the climax and the resolution.
So this is at 7:30. Are you doing two shows?
We are doing two shows.
7:30, 10:30, right?
7:30 and 10:30, and then after that, there is an after party at the Rendezvous.
Okay, so it's at the it's out of Perseverance.
Yeah, the show's at Perseverance, which is really exciting for us to be able to kind of spread our wings a little bit more. We have two professional dancers in our troupe, and I myself have kind of a wildly flailing physical theater person, as well as a little bit of dance. So. It's nice to have more space.
So this is more space than you usually run in?
Yeah, usually we're in smaller cabaret theaters, oftentimes in bars and clubs. And we had a run of 25 shows in London where we had a nice size stage. But more often than not, we end up on awkwardly shaped or small sized stages.
How are the British with how are they with burlesque, your type of burlesque? Did you have to? I guess my question is, did you have to change the show to make it?
We did
make
have
it
to
work?
Change the show. There were a few jokes that just went completely over people's heads, or they just didn't, you know, plain didn't think that they were funny at all, and that was kind of awkward. So we changed the show a little bit. And as soon as we got back to New York and we did our show there, we switched the humor back and we put in those old jokes, and the Americans loved it. So it's interesting. The British are a lot more buttoned up on the surface. They're a little more conservative. On the surface.
Yeah.
So at the beginning of the show, they're all like, well, you know, I guess I'll sit here and watch this. I guess it's mildly entertaining. Lots of golf clapping. And then towards the end of the show, they're a little more rowdy than most of our American audience.
Oh, yeah.
You know, hooting
yeah.
and hollering. And, of course, a few drinks helps them.
But
it was
as
an interesting
as our audiences as well.
Exactly.
So, yeah, okay.
So the rendezvous is bringing a bar to Perseverance.
Ah,
so we can help
okay.
Kind of,
so good.
Get people started clapping early.
Yeah, I think it would be difficult to do burlesque without a bar.
Yeah,
it just doesn't work at all for
right.
me.
Right.
Okay.
It's tradition.
So our audiences in Juneau do not receive burlesque on a regular basis.
Correct.
What do you think?
Well, it's really exciting for me because I knew that I'm sure some Junoites had been other places and seen burlesque before, but I knew that when I did my first show here that it would be very new to most people who stumbled across it. And we've had an overwhelmingly positive reaction. And it's really great, you know, to come here and to be able to share this, what I find exciting discovery somewhere else, and kind of bring this shiny gem back to my hometown and say, look what I found.
Yeah. So, by the way, since you got here, you run into any of your old friends?
I have. It's really hard to do anything. Put gas in the tires, go to the grocery store.
Go to Fred Meyer and you walk into 300
exactly.
people you know.
What are you up to now, Dave? Oh, wow. I tend to lead a very fast-paced life as well. So whenever I see people, there's a lot to catch up on.
Yeah. So, let's make sure that people understand we got to get tickets to this thing. How do you get those?
Yeah, you can find tickets online. You can go through our website, which is modcarousel.com, okay. Or my website, which is theluminouspariah.com. You can go to the Juno Arts and Culture Center or Hearthside Books, and you can find them there.
Okay, so the usual suspects and a couple of websites. Okay.
Exactly.
And the show, the first show is 7:30, mm-hmm. and the second show is 10:30. There's a bar in the lobby. Brought in by Rendezvous, and after the 10:30 show, you're doing a party over at the Rendezvous.
Correct.
Anything you can do a show over there?
You know, we're going to be so exhausted that especially
you'll
after
basically stagger to the bar.
Yeah,
and,
pretty much. I mean, 3 months of solid touring, and this is our final show.
Yeah.
It's good to be back in Juneau, but we're going to want to celebrate a little bit and relax.
Yeah. So after this, what?
After this, we're headed back to Seattle, and we're in a large-scale production there for a week, and then it's on to creating our next show.
Yeah, large-scale production.
Yeah.
What?
This is a show attributed to wine, and I get to play Bacchus, the god of wine and
All
debauchery.
Right. Uh-huh.
So it'll be quite interesting. Yeah. But it's really fun. Seattle is one of the best burlesque scenes in the world, actually, is what we've been discovering. It even competes with New York. They're very different in New York, Seattle, San Francisco. But Seattle is one of the towns where people have the time and energy to sit down and create a full-scale production, not just a couple of acts here and there. So it's been exciting for us to kind of take on that model, and rather than having our usual show that I've been putting on, here in Juneau, which is your basic cabaret, there's a couple of acts that don't really make sense together, and there's an MC that tries to tie it together.
Yeah.
But this show is different in the sense it's very Seattle style. It has a plot, it has a beginning, a middle, an end, and characters that kind of make transformations throughout the evening.
So, tomorrow night, 7:30, 10:30, Perseverance Theater, Mod Carousel. The show's called Wham Bam Kaboom.
Correct.
Three out of work superheroes and an entertainer lady who sort of changes roles as she goes. No further plot devices being given away at this point. And everybody, come on out and watch the show.
Sounds perfect.
Thank you.
I can't wait to see you there.
Yeah.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 27th of July, 2012. It's the birthday of the journalist Joseph Mitchell, born in Fairmont, North Carolina, 1908, and a writer for the New Yorker magazine from 1938 until his death in 1996. It's the birthday of Elizabeth Hardwick, born in Lexington, Kentucky, 1916. She moved to New York to study at Columbia. In 1946, she met the poet Robert Lowell, who was in the midst of a divorce from his first wife. Elizabeth Hardwick married him 3 years later. During their honeymoon, Lowell had a manic depressive attack, and throughout their marriage, he had frequent affairs, breakdowns. Elizabeth Hardwick said, "I didn't know what I was getting into, but even if I had, I still would have married him. He was not crazy all the time. Most of the time, he was wonderful." It was in 1959, an editor at Harper's Magazine, Robert Silvers, put together an issue about the state of literature in America, and he asked Elizabeth Hardwick to write a piece. She wrote an essay, "The Decline of Book Reviewing," in which she said that book reviewers had gone soft in America. They were praising everything. A few years later, Elizabeth Hardwick and Robert Lowell were having dinner with their friends Jason and Barbara Epstein. It was during a strike at the New York Times, so there was no New York Times book review to read, and they talked about starting their own book review. The next morning, Lowell went to the bank and took out a loan for $4,000. They called up Robert Silvers at Harper's, asked if he'd be interested in working as an editor. He said yes, and they put together the first issue of the New York Review of Books at Elizabeth Hardwick's dining room table. It was published in February 1963, had Norman Mailer, William Styron, Mary McCarthy in it. They printed 100,000 copies, which sold out right away. Elizabeth Hardwick wrote many books of fiction, including Sleepless Nights, a collection of essays, Sight Readings, American Fiction. and it's the birthday of the novelist Bharati Mukherjee, born in Calcutta, 1940. She said, "As a bookish child in Calcutta, I used to thrill to the adventures of bad girls whose pursuit of happiness swept them outside the bounds of social decency, Tessa the D'Urbervilles, Emma Bovary, and Anna Karenina lived large in my imagination. Came to America to learn to be a writer, studied at the University of Iowa. Her novels include The Tiger's Daughter, Jasmine, Desirable Daughters, and most recently, Miss New India." Here's a poem for today by George Eliot, "Count That Day Lost." If you sit down at set of sun and count the acts that you have done, and counting, find one self-denying deed, one word that eased the heart of him who heard, one glance most kind that fell like sunshine where it went, then you may count that day well spent. But if, through all the livelong day, you've cheered no heart by yea or nay, if through it all you've nothing done that you can trace that brought the sunshine to one face, no act most small that helped some soul and nothing cost, then count that day as worse than lost." A poem by George Eliot, "Count That Day Lost." That's the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation. iPad users can download the three most recent issues of Poetry Magazine, celebrating its centennial in 2012, at poetryfoundation.org. And by the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the literary arts and the universe of great ideas. Written by Betsy Allister, produced by Joy Biles. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Just coming up on 22 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau. You're listening to Juneau Afternoon. Pat Moore, your host today. My next guest is actually not in the studio with me, as is the usual case, but instead is coming in by telephone from up in Anchorage. And I hope that he's coming in by telephone up in Anchorage. Larry, are you there? Well, we have a problem. So, a bit of music, and we'll sort out the problem. Well, let's try this again. Larry, are you with us? Evidently not. We think we may have solved the problem. Larry Yerich, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Ah, good. Okay. Well, we had a little technical thing there, but now that's over. Larry is with the U.S. Department of Agriculture and is going to talk to us about a series of meetings that are concluding, with the last meeting being in Juneau coming up in just a week or a few days here. And these are meetings between the U.S. Department of Agriculture and Alaskan tribal governments. Why are these meetings being held, Larry?
Well, first, Pat, let me clarify. This is not the last meeting. We have several more meetings to go around the state. We've held five thus far. It'll be five counting the Taslina and Juneau. So, if the if your listeners haven't had an opportunity in their region, we have not come there yet. We're looking forward to meeting folks. And you asked what the purpose of the meetings was, yes?
Yes.
Okay. Our president, this president, Obama, has gone above and beyond in reaching out to tribes to provide due respect to them as sovereign entities as recognized by the federal government. He signed an executive order reconfirming an original executive order issued by President Clinton in 2000. And basically, it's acknowledging the fundamental principles that the U.S. has a unique legal relationship with Indian tribal governments as set forth in the Constitution, various treaties, and other documents. The tribes have a right to self-government, and the United States supports tribal sovereignty and self-determination. There's a lot more that goes to that, and if your listeners have any questions, I'd be happy to provide my phone number here in Anchorage where they can call and I can either speak with them or provide via email more information on the topic.
And why don't we give them that phone number now? We can give it again at the end of the thing. So what number would people call if they do have your questions?
Okay, of course, 907-271-2424, extension 125.
Okay. So you're holding this series of meetings primarily to coordinate between government agencies and tribal governments. Who is it that you want to have in the room with you?
Well, to clarify the first portion, let me just say that rural development is one of several USDA agencies taking the lead on this program, and our Alaska State Director, Jim Nordland, is helming this process. There are five other federal agencies for a total of 10 federal agencies bringing information to elected tribal leaders. Of course, anybody else is welcome to attend, including Native nonprofits, village and regional corporation, Native housing and health organizations. The more people we can empower and through informing them what federal programs are available is better. And essentially, these are informal discussions. They are not rulemaking or consultations. We listen to the concerns expressed by the region's tribal leadership and community members, and then we provide the information that they're looking for. If we don't have it at that particular juncture, if somebody has something that maybe, you know, we need to get back to them, we will certainly do that.
So this is set up more or less as a roundtable discussion within the room?
Yes, sir.
So everyone has access to voice. I mean, you're there to hear as well as to present.
Right. Our main thing is to listen. As you know, the most constructive and productive meetings come from actively listening. And we've prepared a standalone website off of our USDA Rural Development Alaska website. It's really long, so I would encourage your listeners to feel free to contact me. My hours are 7:30 to 4, Monday through Friday, and I'd be happy to provide the link to the website. On the website, I'm providing blogs complete with photographs after each session is held. We have the slideshow presentation. We have the purpose in great detail about the president on down as relates to these meetings and process, the goals, et cetera. And as well, we have the meeting schedule, meeting flyers, et cetera. So there's a plethora of information available, and it's really a user-friendly website.
So are these meetings also being held with tribal government leaders in other areas of the United States as well?
You know, as far as I know, this particular type of process where it is an informal roundtable discussion is unique to Alaska. I can't say with 100% certainty, but that's my understanding, is that this is not a policymaking, and that's the salient difference between what most other meetings are about. This one is, we want to know what you need, and we want to get you the information to make it happen.
Larry, you've identified five general topic areas that are to be discussed or to form the basis, I guess, of the discussion at the meeting. Could you elaborate on those?
Sure. The first one, food production, availability, and nutrition. Our sister agency, helmed, it was a farm service agency helmed by Executive State Director Danny Constantine. And Danny is providing an overview on food security and all the things that go into local sustainable crops and nutrition. He's also imparting information from the USDA agency Food and Nutrition Service. Rural housing, as you know, there are a number of entities in Alaska, as with any other state, including Housing and Urban Development, Alaska Housing and Finance Corporation, and so forth. The rural housing program that the rural development has is unique. We have about nine different housing programs, such as self-help, multifamily housing, single-family housing, and so on, to help meet the need, the various levels of needs for communities in the remote and rural areas of the state. Land management programs, those are helmed by our sister agency, the Natural Resources Conservation Service and the Forest Service. And I do want to be quick to point out that we tailor the meetings for the regions that we're going. Certainly when we met in Bethel, the Forest Service information was available, but we know that the folks up there are not that interested in forests.
I've been to the Bethel International or Bethel National Forest. The tree is lovely.
So you know, I just wanted to make sure your listeners knew that these are not scripted as much as they are open-ended and tailored to best meet the needs appropriately for region to region. The Rural Utilities, the Rural Utility Service is a branch of rural development, USDA Rural Development, and it consists of electric, telecom, solid waste, sewer, and water. And these programs primarily are tailored to help build communities' infrastructure. For instance, in Gullivan, Pitkus Point, and other places around the state that may have still the honey buckets going. Mm-hmm. We are looking to build the infrastructure and bring them out of that and into a more conventional, such as flush tank and haul system than the honey bucket. As well, we have various programs that are designed to not just install, you know, these systems, but to provide the technical and training assistance so that the community can maintain what, you know, what they've got through the funding. Last but not least is rural economic and community development. You know, there are so many different variables with rural economy, especially in the ultra-remote areas, but we're looking to enhance the communities. I'll just name two real quick. Taslina, which is one of the two upcoming meetings on August 3rd. Taslina Rural Development provided a $10 million to help fund their new healthcare and administrative facility, along with, I believe, $8 million from the state and $1 million from HUD, or I may have those figures reversed, but you know, it was a unique collaborative effort. Also, the South Central Foundation's new Valley Native Healthcare Clinic in Wasilla, we're going to the grand opening here on the 1st. And the reason I speak to these is because it's not like suddenly you parachute in a facility. These facilities have to be staffed from entry level and support staff right up to the professional level. So you have a variety of opportunities to bring in and provide jobs. And then people are going to need things and food and fuel, and that's more opportunity to build and more jobs. So it's a win-win for everybody as we provide the information that the rural communities, especially the Alaska Native predominantly Alaska Native population areas, provide them with the information that can help empower them to make choices on these options as they see fit.
Larry, you come off as someone who's very knowledgeable about the process so far. What kinds of inputs have you received from the hearings that have been held? Well, I guess they're not hearings, but the meetings that have been held so far.
And that's a great question. Pat, we have a digital recorder, and the digital recorder is with an omnidirectional speaker so that we are able to capture the meetings in their entirety. And then through that process, afterward, our tribal liaison for Alaska, Tiffany Zilkowski, who is also our West Area Manager up in Bethel, she will transcribe the meeting notes and pull out the highlights. I don't have the highlights in front of me, but one does stick out, which is, you know, the essence of which is we are born here, this is our land, and we're not going to move just because it's tough to live here. So, you know, that elicited, well, we can bring this stuff to you. And these are the mechanisms in place that we can do that. There was also mention of, I want to say, local economy, which through this process, again, we're hoping to bolster the local economic base. And by the way, just because this stuff is occurring out outside of the Anchorage and area proper, and to a great extent Fairbanks and Juneau, doesn't mean that the rural areas of the state, or predominantly Alaska Native rural populations included, that has nothing to do with the major metropolitan areas of the state. Many of the people whose crews go out there to perform the work and construction, and et cetera, they are benefiting because they're the ones sending them out. So I just wanted to make that point too. This is not just about rural or Alaska Native rural villages. This is about everybody.
So Juneau's meeting is when?
Juneau's is August 9th.
Okay.
And that's going to be at the Tlingit Haida Vocational Training and Resource Center, commonly called the VTRC,
yeah,
there on Glacier. And both meetings run 8:30 till 5, of course, you know, factoring in lunch and breaks.
Right.
This is an important process, Pat, because out of all the tribes in the nation, we have 229 federally recognized tribes. That's a big chunk.
Yes.
And that's why it's incumbent on all the agencies involved to try and bring what information we have about programs as asked for. I mean, we bring it all, but we want to, again, say that as they're asking for it, we're providing appropriate answers for their regions.
Larry Yarich with the United States Department of Agriculture and Rural Development in Anchorage. Thank you so much for telling us about the process that's going on with this series of meetings that were mandated by the federal government and which are ongoing, started, I think, in Bethel up in April.
Yes.
Our meeting here in Juneau will be at the Tlingit Haida VTRC out by the hospital on August 9th between 8:30 and 5 o'clock. So put that on your calendar, Juneau. Attend, learn, and put your input in.
And if they wanted my phone number one more time in Anchorage,
yes, please.
907-271-2424, extension 125.
Thank you very much, Larry.
Thank you, and have a great weekend.
You too. Two. It's 20 minutes, well, actually 18 minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News. Weather forecast just got updated a couple of minutes ago. So for tonight, cloudy with scattered showers. The low's around 52. Northwest winds 10 miles per hour. Those should become southwest overnight. Saturday, we're looking at cloudy with scattered showers. Highs around 64. Southwest winds 10 miles per hour. Those are supposed to shift to the northwest in the late afternoon. And then Saturday night, mostly cloudy, isolated showers, lows around 52, northwest winds. I like that isolated, and that's pretty good. Sunday, mostly cloudy, isolated showers, highs around 62. So it looks like it's not going to be quite as wet as it has been with the return of the rains that we had earlier today when it was really pouring down for a little while there, just for a brief period. Anyway, my next guest is hoping for sunny weather for a picnic coming up here. So we're talking about the first National Guard Day to be held at Sandy Beach. So Matt Metcalf, tell us the story here.
Well, we're having the celebration. Just the governor just declared it as a day every year to celebrate the service of people who served in the National Guard, Air National Guard, and Army National Guard. And the governor is expected to be there for the celebration. It's from 4:30 to 7:30 Monday at Sandy Beach. And we'll have food and drinks. And I see it personally as a chance to get together with people that I served with over the past 20 years that I haven't seen in a long time. Like a lot of organizations, once you retire and leave, or your commitment is up, you've spent a lot of time with some individuals and made some good friendships, mm-hmm. but you go your separate ways. And so this is a chance, we hope, for people going back at least as far as the 60s who have served in the Guard to come to Sandy Beach, and hopefully they'll meet people they served with.
So, Mac, you've kind of had the world tour as a guest of the National Guard, as we say. You've been around a little bit.
I did. I first went in the regular army. I was drafted in 68, went to Vietnam, got out, joined the Guard as I was teaching on Prince Wales Island. I was about in my early 40s and got a little bored and joined the National Guard. And like a lot of people, I was deployed. There are ongoing deployments for the last 10 years, so we've had a lot of people go all over the world, Iraq, Afghanistan. I was sent to Kuwait, and we had missions into Iraq. People go to Mongolia. I went to Mongolia for a short time, and then Guatemala was one place. We have an aviation unit here in Juneau that's been deployed to Iraq numerous times. Anyway, all of the people now in the National Guard are used to going on deployments. And the celebration is not just for the soldiers, it's for the soldiers' families. Mm-hmm. And we hope to see them on Monday night, Monday evening.
Where are Alaska Guard units currently deployed?
Well, I know that they are in Afghanistan. We were just talking, and you have a friend, I have a friend who are, they're both in Afghanistan with the National Guard. And that unit, my friend's in an infantry company, and he's due back, in the next few months. And there are possible deployments for other Guard units coming up. And we expect that to continue. People go to a lot of places. Haiti's been one place they went to in the last couple of years. That was a war zone too. But anyway, people are seeing serious duty and serious situations.
How long has the Guard been in existence in Juneau?
The very first unit established in Alaska was Alpha Company in Juneau. They started organizing in 1940, I think it was activated in 41, and then deployed shortly thereafter to Fort Chilkoot in Haines, which was a turn-of-the-century operation. They had a washerwoman's alley where soldiers got their clothes cleaned. They had their main form of transportation was mule. They had a blacksmith or blacksmiths. And there were people I knew who went up there with that unit. One was a teacher I had, Max Lewis. And I think a lot of people who went to high school here in the 50s and 60s remember Max. He was in that unit, went to Haines, became an officer, went to Europe. That unit was split up. Individuals went different places. Mm-hmm. And he earned a Silver Star. And after World War II, they reestablished the Guard, and it's been going ever since. And so we hope to get some people, maybe hopefully going back to the 60s.
Hmm.
Show up on a Monday night. That'd be great. Yeah. And even farther back would be even better. But they're getting the ranks are thinning there.
Where all is the Guard physically located in Juneau?
We were located just across the street from where we're at the Subport, and then the Armory.
It is now the Jack.
Yeah, now the Jack.
Yeah.
And now we're out at the university.
Okay.
And they have a facility out there that's shared with the university. It's a gym and indoor running track and a lot of different things. And then there the aviation unit, the Army aviation unit with Blackhawks is at the airport.
Mm-hmm.
And then around southeast, you have units, Armory in Ketchikan and Sitka. And depending on the number of Guard members, there are little armories in places like Wrangell, Hoona, and Goon. On Prince of Wales Island. So when I was mobilized with the 6th Battalion, all sorts of soldiers there were 600 people, and there were soldiers from all over Alaska, and a lot of them were from Southeast, and all of the communities were representative from Skagway to Ketchikan.
Mac, does the Guard have a local mission as well as being deployed to war zones?
Right. The Alaska Guard is kind of unusual in that the National Guard is unusual in that every state has their own National Guard,
mm-hmm.
and the governor controls it until the president calls a unit or all the units up. Then they become part of the regular Army or part of the regular Air Force. But here, the governor is in charge, as in the other states, unless they're deployed, and they're here primarily to assist in emergencies, state mm-hmm. emergencies. And they have a lot of different tools to help, including helicopters, aircraft that can bring in large amounts of supplies, soldiers that can be deployed for security reasons or to do pick and shovel work,
mm-hmm.
whatever's needed.
Mm-hmm. So the event that you're particularly working your way toward here is on Monday, the 30th of July.
Correct.
It's out on Sandy Beach. And it's basically an afternoon and evening picnic from 4:30 to 7:30.
Yes.
You got cover in case it rains?
We do. We have two shelters.
Okay. Good idea.
Yeah, we're going to have a lot of food. We've raised a couple $1,000. We have a lot of sponsors, and they've given us a money or food or drink, so if people show up, they're going to get a good meal.
Well, the Weather Bureau is telling you that Monday night you'll have cloudy with scattered showers, highs around 60, and then Monday night, which is what you're most interested in, says mostly cloudy, chance of rain with lows around 50 and highs around 60, so you better keep the shelters at hand, well at hand, but chance of rain is there's hope.
Sounds good.
There's hope. Well, I wish you great success in this. I think it's a great undertaking to kind of provide an opportunity for a whole bunch of people who've been associated with the National Guard and are associated with the National Guard the chance to get together and socialize a little bit. And of course, the general public's invited as well to the.
No. It's primarily for the current and former National Guard members and their families. And we've invited different people. We expect some city assembly members, the governor, of course, and other people that VFW and American Legion, some representatives from those organizations.
Mm-hmm.
But that's who it's for. And we have, again, a lot of sponsors. We have most of the grocery stores helping out. We have a lot of cores mining. I didn't bring my list, it's not in front of me, but we have about 10, 15 sponsors who've all helped out to make this a success.
Okay.
And anyway, I hope to see a lot of people out there.
Well, I hope you get them, too. Thanks, Matt.
Bears are a common sight in Juneau, and every year residents are reminded to store garbage and food attractants properly to reduce bear and human conflicts. This year, new garbage cans that are neither bear-proof or resistant have been delivered to local residents. Local wildlife managers ask that residents do their very best to store the new cans in an enclosure such as a garage or shed that bears cannot access. Juneau has proven time and again to be a resourceful community in addressing refuse management and local bears. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game thanks you for your efforts.
Quick announcement here. The concerts in the park will be held at the JACC, the Jack, today due to rain. And since the Jack is 39 years old today, they'll be serving cake and goodies at the concert, and they're offering a 39% discount on season tickets. They'll also have volunteer slots out for grabs, and those who like to volunteer at various season events should get there and grab them up, because they go sooner rather than later. Usually if you volunteer to assist at one of the events, you wind up getting into the event without charge. So, concerts in the park at the Jack, and the Jack is 39 years old today.
Spirit of Youth celebrates teenage Alaskans who are making our communities better places to live. They give their time, their hearts and minds, their passion, their creativity. Now, hear their stories.
We were just leaving the hotel. There was a guy that came running out into the lobby, and he said, "There's a girl that was drowning in the pool." And that's when I followed, like, I dropped everything I had, and I just followed him.
This is 15-year-old Anthony Keller of Wasilla. He's remembering back to a trip he took to Kenai late last year.
Some lady already has jumped into the hot tub and taken the girl out of it, and she was unconscious. After a little bit, like, nobody there knew CPR, and I said that I was certified as a CPR and first aid, and that I can do it. And that's when I gave her CPR, and after a little bit, she pretty much just came back to life.
A few months before this incident, Anthony took a CPR and first aid training course as part of K'nick Tribal Council's Rural Youth Services program. It was by chance that he got the training. He was added last minute to fill up the class. It was also chance that put him in the right place at the right time that day.
After that happened, I noticed that, like, when it comes to a hard situation, I don't get nervous. I just, like, get into it and just do what I have to do.
Kevin Toothaker works with K'nick Tribal Council and says he's really proud of Anthony.
As far as seeing his potential, I like to feel like I'm the weatherman of potential, and I could try to see what people are good at. And he's got a good bone. He's got a great soul. He's just a good young man.
At the moment, Anthony is living with his grandparents down south. I'm Shanna Sheehy.
Give a young person you know a boost by recognizing the good things they're doing. Nominate at spiritofyouth.org.
Provided by the Alaska State Division of Behavioral Health.
Lovely piano and guitar blues have been provided to us by the two musicians who are kind of the core of the music for Prairie Home Companion. Butch Johnson and Butch Thompson and Pat Donahue have put out a thing called Vicksburg Blues, and we've been shooting a few cuts off that album for you today. You're in tune with KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas, and we also broadcast on a set of translators that work throughout the area. In the Valley and Auk Bay, you can tune to K276 AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K269AO transmits on 101.7 MHz. Gustavus hears us on K201 AM. It's on 88.1 MHz. K220BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, KTOO has a signal on K210 AS at 89.9 MHz. In Juneau, you can also get KTOO on GCI Cable Juneau and Digital Channel 871. KRNN and KXLL, our sister stations, are at Digital Channel 872 and 873. And we also stream continuously on www.ktoo.org.